started. And every time I come, they are so pleased to see me, and they need a break, and I'm an extra pair of hands, and it makes a huge difference. And thirdly, it's one case at a time, but I'm definitely making a difference, and I know we've saved some lives.
Dr. Victoria Rose, I want to thank you so much for joining us from Khan Yunis in Gaza. Khan Yunis, the second largest city in the Gaza Strip. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at how criticism of Israel is growing in Europe as the UK pauses trade talks and the EU reviews its relationship with Israel. Then we'll go to South Africa, a day after the South African president meets with President Trump at the Oval Office, and President Trump charges white genocide, as the president of South Africa says that's a conspiracy theory that's not true. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about greed.
Greed is a poison rising in the land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops, it works, is never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed.
Greed by Sweet Honey in the Rock, in our Democracy Now! Firehouse studios years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to look at how criticism of Israel is growing in Europe as the UK pauses trade talks and the EU reviews its relationship with Israel. This is British Prime Minister Keir Starmer speaking Tuesday.
But first, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to say something about the horrific situation in Gaza, where the level of suffering, innocent children being bombed again, is utterly intolerable. The recent announcement that Israel will allow a basic quantity of food into Gaza, a basic quantity, is totally and utterly inadequate. So we must coordinate our response, because this war has gone on for far too long. We cannot allow the people of Gaza to starve.
Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, long an ally of Israel. The British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, also condemned Israel's actions in Gaza in a speech to the House of Commons.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, end this blockade now and let the aid in. Regrettably, Madam Deputy Speaker, despite our efforts, this Israeli government's egregious actions and rhetoric have continued. They are isolating Israel from its friends and partners around the world, undermining the interests of the Israeli people, and damaging the image of the State of Israel in the eyes of the world. Therefore, today, I'm announcing that we have suspended negotiations with this Israeli government on a new free trade agreement.
The comments of the British Foreign Secretary and Prime Minister came days after as many as 500,000 people took part in a massive march for Palestine in London to mark the 77th anniversary of the Nakba. Meanwhile, the European Union has announced it's reviewing its relationship with Israel.
We're joined now by two guests. From Brussels, Lynn Boylan is with us, Irish member of the European Parliament, chair of the European Parliament's Delegation for Relations with Palestine. And joining us from London, British MP, former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, MP Corbyn. If you could start off by responding to the shift. We just were in Gaza talking to a British doctor who's there helping the children and the people of Gaza, saying that what Keir Starmer has done does make a difference. Now, you were certainly opposed to the prime minister and so much of the support of Israel. What is causing the shift in the British government's position?
It's pretty clear that the huge demonstrations in Britain and the outpouring of
public condemnation of Israel's bombardment of Gaza has eventually forced the British government into a slightly different position, in that they've now suspended, as you reported, the trade talks with Israel. They claim to have suspended all arms supplies to Israel, but we question that because we believe that parts for the F-35 jets are still being sold to Israel. And we're also questioning the amount of arms that have been sold over the last few months. But there's no doubt that the position of the Palestinian people being starved to death, bombed to death in Gaza, has forced the British government into a different position. We are keeping up all the pressure we can in order to get aid in, but also to end the occupation, because that is clearly what the ICJ position is: end the occupation of Gaza and of the West Bank.
Well, let's bring in Lynn Boylan. Lynn, you are a member of European Parliament. Could you talk about, and also chair of the European Parliament's Delegation for Relations with Palestine, if you could talk about the significance of this review? The European Union is, of course, Israel's largest trading partner. But what do you think could come of this review, given that there is no unanimous position within the European Union on Israel?
Well, I think first and foremost, I'd echo what Jeremy is saying, is that the only reason why the EU has announced this review, and there isn't even a majority at the EU Council level to review the trading agreement, is because of the people power and the pressure that is coming on politicians right across the European Union. And I'd encourage people to continue to do that. But I would say that the time for a review is long since passed. So what we're calling for is to suspend the agreement pending the review. The review can take place. They can do the research. If they haven't seen what everybody has seen on their phone, is that Israel is not upholding human rights and Article 2 of the trading agreement. It should be suspended. But we're calling for them to suspend it, then carry out your review and come back with your findings. But what we're fearing is that the announcing a review is like kicking it down the road. It's, I suppose, addressing the people pressure, but actually not doing anything concrete to address the situation. So we're also calling on MEPs right across Europe who are frustrated by the lack of European-wide action to call on their national governments to end trade with Israel. For example, in Ireland, we have what's called the Occupied Territories Bill, which would cease trade, obviously, just with the occupied territories, but it would be a significant message sent out that at least Ireland wants to be compliant with international law. And we're encouraging MEPs across Europe to do similar initiatives in their countries.
And so, Jeremy Corbyn, if you could talk about what sanctions the UK has already imposed on Israel and against whom, and talk about the new inquiry. You've been calling for a new inquiry into Britain's relationship with Israel. If you could tell us what that's about.
Sure. On June the 4th, I'm introducing a private member's bill into the House of Commons calling for an independent inquiry into the whole process of policy making in relation to Gaza, the West Bank, and Britain's arms supplies to Israel, particularly during the period since October 2023. This is similar to the inquiry that was headed by Sir John Chilcot eventually to inquire into policy making surrounding the Iraq war. My purpose in doing this is because the government has obfuscated on many, many occasions over the past 18 months over the level of arms supplies, over trade, over aid, over credits and so on to Israel, and also particularly about the manufacture of Israeli weapons in Britain, particularly in Sheffield and other places where parts with the F-35 are made. So a group of us in Parliament have been raising this consistently. The issue of arms supplies goes something like this. Britain was and remains to some extent a supplier of arms to Israel. David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, suspended 30 arms licenses out of 300 that were in operation without ever specifying what these 30 licenses were. And to be honest, I still don't know what those 30 arms licenses are. He claims they were oversupply of weapons that could be used for crimes against humanity. But we later discovered that many weapons have continued to be supplied, and yet yesterday we published a report from Progressive International and other groups, which is outlining the whole case for suspending arms supplies and pointing out the dishonesty of the British government over the past 18 months on this. And that report is being circulated to MPs and will be part of the case I'll be making to the British Parliament on June the 4th. The question of suspending the trade talks is an interesting one and a very interesting development, because to some extent it is running in tandem and parallel rather with what the European Union is doing, because Britain is no longer a member of the European Union. We welcome that suspension. There has always been the legal case against buying settlement goods because of the illegality of the settlements, but it has been very hard to trace what are settlement goods and what isn't. But actually, a consumer boycott is gathering pace. The members of the Cooperative Society, a very big retailer in Britain with a huge membership base across the whole country, voted by 70% last week to request their board to suspend all purchases from Israel, so no Israeli products would be stocked in co-op shops. And there's a lot of pressure on to the other big retailers to do the same. So there's been an enormous shift in public opinion, and it's caused by utter revulsion at seeing emaciated children starve to death or dying on the operating theatre where there's no anaesthetics or even antiseptics to treat their terrible conditions they're suffering. People can stomach no longer the sight of Palestinian children being starved and murdered by the Israeli occupation of Gaza.
MP Corbyn, the UK sanctioned violent West Bank settlers, but the British Foreign Minister Lammy stopped short of targeting Israeli officials. Can you talk about the significance of those sanctions and what you think has to go further?
The sanctions themselves against individual violent settlers are important and a good step forward. So far, the only sanctions apply to Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, who have arrest warrants out from the International Criminal Court, and Britain, as a signatory to the Rome Convention, is required to carry out those arrest warrants should either of those individuals turn up in UK territory. What David Lammy stopped short of doing was what many of us requested, which is a wider sanctioning of officials in the Israeli government who've been a party to the decision-making on the bombardment of Gaza. Their names are well known, but also of Israeli Defense Force High Command, who are also obviously very much part of the decision-making process on which buildings to bomb and which buildings to blow up. Not that there's many buildings left in Gaza that are still to be blown up. And so we are continuing that pressure. So there's a big move in Parliament on military equipment, on demanding aid get in rapidly to Gaza, and also sanctions against Israeli officials. And so changes are happening, but it's desperately slow, and already over 60,000 have died in Gaza.
Can I also ask you about your response to what happened in Washington? All these young embassy and consular staffers from different consulates and organizations gathered at the Jewish Museum, and young men opened fire, killing two of those who worked at the Israeli embassy. Your response?
It's absolutely shocking. Nobody should be shot. Nobody should be killed at any event anywhere around the world. That is not the way to solve the issue. And so we have to be resolute in demanding peace for all, and also recognize that in the case of Britain and also in the case of the USA, the big demonstrations in support of the Palestinian people are of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, and people of no particular faith. And one of the biggest groups on our demonstrations in support of the Palestinian people is actually the Jewish bloc.
Lynn Boylan, finally, before we end, if you could also respond to events here in Washington, D.C., the killing of these two Israeli embassy staffers, and then the fact that within the EU, it's France that's leading efforts for the official recognition of Palestine. If you could talk about the significance of that, France meeting Saudi Arabia next month, apparently in New York. Foreign Secretary Lammy has said he's also in in talks with France and Saudi Arabia about officially recognizing Palestine? Please.
Yeah, and just to echo, I suppose, what Jeremy has said, and send my condolences to the family of the two who were shot dead last night. Nobody should be losing their lives. What we want to see is peace. We want to have a long-standing peace in Gaza, in Palestine, for the Palestinian people and Jewish people to be able to live in peace. In regards to President Macron and leading the case for the recognition of the state of Palestine, it is very welcome. Ireland and Spain recognised Palestine, I think it was about a year ago, Sweden some years before. It is important. It's a really significant step, and I'm sure it'd be very much welcomed by the Palestinian people. But for me, the urgency within the EU now is ending the blockade, is demanding the ceasefire. And demanding the ceasefire means that EU countries need to stop supplying weapons to Israel. So while Jeremy was talking about Britain's role in arming Israel, we have countries within the EU who are significant weapons providers to the Israeli state. If they wanted this conflict and this war and genocide to end tomorrow, then they need to stop supplying weapons to Israel. And the F-35s is a critical part of that. We also need to see the aid getting in, and the aid needs to be delivered and supported through UNRWA. And we're fighting very hard back at any push to militarize the aid agenda. And we're seeing Israel talking about setting up compounds where, women would have to go to areas, putting themselves in vulnerable positions, people with disabilities, children having to go, and that Israel would decide who is deserving and who isn't deserving of aid. This cannot be tolerated. What we need is UNRWA to be allowed to do their job, lift the blockade, let the trucks in, and deliver the aid to the people who so desperately need it. Those children, 14,000 children who are at risk of dying from starvation in the next 48 hours, that's where our focus should be. Absolutely recognise the state of Palestine, but right now the people of Palestine need food, they need medicine, they need water, and they need to stop the bombs dropping on them.
Lynn Boylan, we want to thank you for being with us from Brussels, Irish member of the European Parliament, MEP, and chair of the European Parliament's Delegation for Relations with Palestine. And we want to thank Jeremy Corbyn in London, member of the British Parliament, former Labour Party leader there. Next up, we go to South Africa, a day after the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, met with President Trump at the Oval Office, calmly rejecting Trump's false claims of a white genocide in South Africa. Back in 20 seconds.
And now I see the wind blowing from northwest, and I hear those honkers again.
The late, great Michael Hurley performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see our interview with him and more songs, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa visited the White House Wednesday, where President Trump used their joint Oval Office appearance to push false claims that white Afrikaner farmers are facing a genocide. During an extraordinary confrontation broadcast on live TV, Trump had the lights dimmed and ordered video clips played showing people calling for violence against white farmers in South Africa. This is President Ramaphosa and Trump responding to a reporter's question before Trump started playing the video.
What does it take for you to be convinced that there's no white genocide in South Africa?
Well, I can answer that for the president. It's for him. No, seriously.
I'd rather have him answer.
Yeah, I know the answer.
It will be. My president will respond to you.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. President.
It will take President Trump listening to the voices of South Africans, some of whom are his good friends, like those who are here. When we have talks between us on a quiet table, it will take President Trump to listen to them. I'm not going to be repeating what I've been saying. I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me. So it'll take him, President Trump, listening to their stories, to their perspective. That is the answer to your question.
But, Mr. President, I must say that we have... Wait. We have thousands of stories talking about it.
Sure.
And we have documentaries, we have news stories. And that, is Natalie here, somebody here to turn that? I could show you a couple of things. And I would... It has to be responded to.
Yeah, sure.
Let me see the articles, please, if you would. And turn the lights down. Turn the lights down and just put this on. It's right behind you.
As the video played, President Trump falsely claimed there is a place in South Africa with 1,000 graves of white farmers.
Now, this is right bad. These are burial sites right here. Burial sites. Over 1,000 of white farmers. And those cars are lined up to pay love on a Sunday morning. Each one of those white things you see is a cross. And there's approximately 1,000 of them. They're all white farmers, the family of white farmers. And those cars aren't driving. They're stopped there to pay respects to their family member who was killed. And it's a terrible sight. I've never seen anything like it.
The video President Trump was talking about did not actually show any real graves. They were mock graves, part of a protest against farm violence. South African police data show farm murders comprised less than 0.2% of South African murders between October and December of last year. This month, the Trump administration granted refugee status to a group of white South Africans, even as it suspended refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. Trump's claims of white genocide come after South Africa brought a case at the International Court of Justice in The Hague accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza, where Palestinian officials say Israeli attacks have killed over 61,000 people. And one of his closest advisors, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, is also from South Africa and is part of that group of people pushing these theories. For more, we go to Johannesburg, South Africa, where we're joined by Lebohang Peko. She is senior research fellow and political economist at Trade Collective Works, founding fellow at the Thabo Mbeki School of Governance at the University of South Africa. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you respond to the spectacle in the Oval Office yesterday?
So, yeah, thanks, Amy. The whole spectacle that we saw yesterday is really in keeping with the narrative of this white genocide. But it's a convenient myth, especially in the context of a declining empire. So this is a sort of white supremacist tactic, which is aware that its days are numbered, and it's kind of trying to concoct and invent imagined threats to galvanize support and to galvanize sympathy. And I think I'm very wary of the notion of even calling it white victimhood, because I consider it an act of aggression, an act of aggressive white malice, in fact. And what this does is that the velocity of media amplification, as well as the endorsements by billionaires like, as you mentioned, Elon Musk and the few other prominent former South Africans who, by bizarre coincidence, have congregated around the Trump administration, and perhaps it's not coincidental at all, like Peter Thiel, like Joel Pollack, and a few others, is that they have then exported their sense of white grievance. So these are grievances that have been around since the post-1994 dispensation in pockets, but nobody takes them really, really seriously, and they're seen as spurious, apartheid, nostalgic sentiments. And what has happened, of course, in the last few months with the ascendancy of people like Elon Musk and Joel Pollack and their proximity to somebody like, Donald Trump, who seems to have a great appetite for these spurious white supremacist ideologies, is that they mirror his own extremely skewed worldview and, of course, his own racial tendencies. And they've amplified their power, their velocity, their financial muscle have given them the ability to amplify this. And we see this, of course, that Elon Musk has used Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it this week, to amplify some very problematic and extremely dangerous propaganda.
And also, if you could talk overall of the steps the Trump administration has taken against South Africa since they came, it came into office. I mean, this is just one aspect of it. Secretary of State Marco Rubio skipping a G20 meeting earlier this year, claiming that South Africa is what he called the present government's anti-Americanism, he said. Trump has also stopped foreign aid to South Africa and set 30% reciprocal tariffs in April, though now that has been paused for a 90-day review.
So these, the tariffs are, of course, universal. We know that Donald Trump went on this tariff spree a few weeks ago, and that South Africa was but one of many recipients of that unfortunate trade aggression. The other thing is that, of course, we should be mindful that the use of tariffs in this regard is really, not only is it aggressive, it's also, it's extraneous. It is actually outside the World Trade Organization regulations. And even though I am no sponsor and no praising of the World Trade Organization, I think in and of itself is a imbalanced neocolonial instrument. It has to be said that it has brought into that the behavior of Donald Trump and the Trump administration towards South Africa and towards the global economic architecture in recent weeks and months illustrates that this kind of maverick John Wayne approach that he seems to be taking, and that it's really trying to hark back to some sort of an old Western style. It's just like watching an old Western movie unfold. And when you mention, you know, the aggression that's taken place against South Africa recently, I think what's also quite interesting and that many of us are noting is the mirroring and the resonance between the grievance of whiteness in this country and the grievances, the invented grievances that people like Donald Trump are inventing, this notion that there are, that, you know, there's replacement theory and so forth. I think in material terms, South Africa is actually relatively wealthy. The way, of course, that we sometimes distribute our funds and spend our resources, a conversation for another day. But as a country, we're actually quite wealthy. And I think that this is what it pains many of us, that we had to be placed in a situation, or we chose to be placed in a situation of having to almost apologize for ourselves and to defend spurious and absolutely toxic lies.
Lebang, I wanted to read you Naomi Klein's quote, staging a show and tell about a fake genocide during a real genocide to the government that's done the most to seek justice for that real genocide is designed to break our brains. They know what they are doing. Your final comments is even the 59 refugees who came, one of them has been researched, sending out and retweeting anti-Semitic comments against Jews. And of course, we know about Elon Musk, South African, who did the Heil Hitler salute.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the 59 so-called, I think we should be cautious. I mean, 59, 49, we should be cautious of calling them refugees, firstly, because it certainly cheapens the many displaced people across the world who are truly unable to return to their countries for fear of persecution and killing. Secondly, I think that we need to dispose of the idea that all Afrikaners are farmers. They are not. Thirdly, we also need to dispose of the idea that only Afrikaners work this land. And I think that the way that their farming expertise has been centered is deeply offensive. The farm workers, the thousands of farm workers who die, some often at the hands of farm owners, white farm owners, is an absolutely underrepresented and underspoken phenomena in this whole scenario. And I think that we should also reimagine what a multilateral world would look like if it decentered this kind of white malice and if it actually decentered these manufactured, convenient truths that people like Trump and his ilk are spewing. And we can also see that there's this resonance across the world. It's not just the United States. It's Italy, it's Germany, it's the United Kingdom, and so on. And I think whiteness in general is in crisis, and it's responding with great vindictiveness and toxicity.
Lebohang Fekwa, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Research Fellow and Political Economist at Trade Collective Works. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.